This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The coronavirus that causes COVID-19 took most of the world by surprise, but not Ralph Baric. He's an epidemiologist at UNC Chapel Hill who's been dubbed the coronavirus hunter. He's been tracking coronaviruses for decades and working on medications to treat coronavirus-caused infections, including remdesivir, a drug the FDA approved for COVID-19 treatment with an emergency use authorization earlier this month. Ralph Baric spoke recently with our WUNC colleagues, Terry and Joe Graydon of the People's Pharmacy, and we're going to share that conversation with you on this program today. Ralph Baric is the William R. Keenan, Jr. Distinguished Professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Joe and Terry started the conversation by asking him how he got the name Coronavirus Hunter.
Well, that's always a good question. Maybe because I've studied coronaviruses for 35 years and worked with animal and human strains. We've also done some work in discovery looking for new coronaviruses that exist in animal populations that may threaten human health, human or animal health for that matter. And so I imagine that those are the likely reasons that people would refer to me in that manner.
Well, how did you get interested in coronaviruses? I mean, that is what you have dedicated your career to. And yet, that's kind of unusual. A lot of people would say that's a very narrow field that didn't have much promise until the last several months. How did you get into it?
Yeah, I have a unique capacity to choose an area of research that others aren't working in. So I had, after I'd finished my doctorate degree working on alpha viruses, and these are viruses like Western and Eastern equine encephalitis virus. These are RNA viruses that are transmitted by insect vectors. I was looking for a postdoctoral fellowship, and I had a couple of opportunities, one of which was to work with this new sort of emerging diseases that was occurring in mostly homosexual men, which was ended up being called AIDS. And HIV, or to work on coronaviruses. And I was very interested in coronaviruses because I really took a sort of a fiendish delight in understanding how RNA viruses could replicate. And coronaviruses looked quite interesting at the time. They had a very large genome, perhaps the largest RNA virus genome in nature. And it looked like they had a novel replication strategy and transcription strategy that would allow them to express a large number of smaller RNAs in the infected cell. And I wanted to understand how that process worked. And so I went to work on coronaviruses.
Dr. Baric, I wonder if you can tell us, what is a coronavirus? And, you know, we're not very technical, so
sure.
You have a simple explanation.
Coronaviruses are a group of what are called RNA viruses. They have an RNA virus genome, and they have a unique appearance in the electron microscope. So when you look at them under a really, really powerful microscope, you can see this spherical particle, almost like a circle, that has these surface projections that poke out from the circle. And so that looks like a corona or a halo of around the sun, hence the name coronavirus. And these viruses primarily infected humans at the time that I was beginning to do work on them. We knew that they caused common cold viruses. They were common cold viruses and caused common colds, but occasionally more severe respiratory tract infections in the elderly and infants. And I was interested in a virus called mouse hepatitis virus because it was a sort of a prototype virus in the coronavirus family that caused a demyelinating disease that was used as a model for multiple sclerosis. So I was able to do two things, chase two passions. One passion was to ask very detailed questions about how this group of viruses could replicate and express the genes in the genome, and then try to link that to how they produce disease.
Dr. Baric, when did you begin to think that coronaviruses could be really, really important to human health? I mean, besides the common cold, yeah, we all know about that. But it turns out that coronaviruses can be something far worse. And we got a little hint of that several years ago. Did you ever imagine something like a pandemic that we're facing now?
Well, one of the topic areas that we became very interested in the 1990s was asking questions about how easily coronaviruses could move between species. And the reason I became interested in that question was that because there were a variety of novel animal coronaviruses that were emerging and causing outbreaks of disease in pigs and dogs and cats. And that suggested that the virus as a family was able to traffic maybe much easier between species than we'd ever imagined. So when I first started, they were thought to be very species specific. But by the 90s, there was a fair amount of evidence beginning to emerge that suggested that these might be much more mobile viruses in nature in terms of their ability to move between species. So we set up experiments in the laboratory working with mouse hepatitis virus and asking how easily could you actually select for virus variants that could grow in other species type cells. And so we asked the question, could we adapt mouse hepatitis virus to grow in hamster cells in the test tube, you know, on the bench? You know, normally mouse hepatitis virus can't grow in hamster cells at all, but within a few passages and maybe a month of hard work, we were able to isolate viruses that could grow to almost 100 million virus particles in a culture. And it was only a couple of mutations that were required to do that. And that data really suggested to us that coronaviruses were quite plastic and were able to jump between species. And we actually wrote a paper, 97, 98, saying that the research community really needed to consider coronaviruses as potentially emerging viruses in the future.
And of course, that was just before SARS, right?
That was about 4 years before SARS. That's right. So, and then SARS emerged in 2003 to cause a an epidemic that involved about 30-some countries and 8,000 people with about 800 deaths globally. And then that outbreak was controlled by public health intervention strategies. About 9 years later, MERS, or Middle East Respiratory Coronavirus, emerged in the Middle East and has caused about 2,500 cases with a 36% mortality rate. And then finally, in 2019, we had the SARS-2 virus emerge from bats in China to cause 3 million infections and countless suffering and death across the globe.
And that, of course, is what we're looking at right now.
That's correct. Correct. We're in a global pandemic. So we've had coronaviruses. We've had three emerging coronaviruses in the 21st century that caused human disease. One was a medium-sized epidemic. One is a smaller epidemic, that's MERS. And then we have a global pandemic, which is SARS-2. And you will be probably surprised to know that interspaced in between those three human emerging viruses, we've had other emerging viruses that have spilled over into pig populations, like porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, which killed 12 million piglets in the United States in 2012. And then a new coronavirus called SADS coronavirus, or a severe acute diarrhea coronavirus, emerged in China and spilled over into swine populations. And so in the first 20 years of the 21st century, we're looking at five or six emerging coronaviruses that came out of bats.
All of them from bats?
Yes. So there has been a paradigm shift in terms of the ability of coronaviruses to emerge. And just to take you and the listeners back so that you understand the history of coronaviruses, there are four contemporary human coronaviruses. One is called NL63. One is called 229E. One is called OC43. And another is called HKU1. And these are four very different viruses. It turns out that 229E emerged about 200 to 400 years ago from a bat coronavirus. NL63 emerged from a bat coronavirus about 800 years ago. OC43 emerged from a bovine coronavirus around the turn of the 20th century, and we still haven't figured out where HKU1 comes from. So put the 2019 pandemic in perspective. When you look at 7 human coronaviruses that have emerged over the last 800 years, 7 of them came from bats.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The State of Things featuring an episode of the program The People's Pharmacy. It's produced in the studios of WUNC and hosted by Terry and Joe Graydon. Today, we're sharing an interview with a man known as the coronavirus hunter. Ralph Barrick is an epidemiologist who spent the past 3 decades studying coronaviruses. He's a key member of the team that's been involved in bringing the drug remdesivir to fight against COVID-19. He spoke with Terry and Joe Graydon of the People's Pharmacy earlier this month, and we're sharing that episode today. They started this segment by asking him how it's possible to safely study a dangerous virus.
Oh, that's a great question. We have what are called biological safety level 3 research facilities. These are negative containment facilities. So the air only moves from the hallway into the research facility and then up venting through special filters that remove viruses from the air. And to work in this facility, which includes an outer room for where you can doff and don what's called PPE or protective equipment, then you have an inner, usually you have an inner room that you go through before you can actually move into the BSL-3 facility. The PPE that we wear are Tyvek suits, and we have hoods with powered breathing apparatuses that basically pump air up through a filter that could remove all viruses and organics and other things in the air, so that a clean, pathogen-free air is blown into a hood that you wear over your head, and you have plexiglass faceplate, and that provides the worker with air, and then you work under those conditions. So in our BSL-3 facilities, you need to think of it as basically a 3-tiered system. First, the pathogens are maintained in biological safety cabinets, which are designed to provide curtains of air to prevent the release of the virus to get out of that cabinet. Second, we have the workers who are completely covered in Tyvek suits that are disposable, that protect the worker from any potential exposure event. And then on top of that, we have that the worker has their own air breathing equipment so that if anything should happen in the facility, they would still be safe. And then finally, the facility itself is negative containment, so the air flows into the facility and up through a HEPA filter so that the community is also safe. And so that's how we work with the virus. We've worked with highly pathogenic coronaviruses since about 2004. And that includes the original 2003 SARS coronavirus strain, the Middle East respiratory coronavirus strain with its very high mortality rate. And then of course the COVID-19 SARS-2 virus. The mortality rate of those 3 viruses is SARS is about 10%. Middle Eastern respiratory coronavirus is about 35%. And we're not really sure exactly what the mortality rate of SARS-2 is. If you just do the math between the cases that have been reported and the number of deaths, it's 7%. But it's probably more on line of about 3%, 2 or 3%, which is quite high.
Still pretty high.
Pretty high and pretty scary. There is a controversy, and I don't want to dig too deeply into this, about the laboratory in Wuhan, China. Do they have the kind of safety precautions that you have at the University of North Carolina? And do you have any thoughts about whether this virus was a natural, quote unquote, bat to human transfer, or was there something a little bit more perhaps insidious involved?
Well, of course, the answer to those questions are in China, and it's very difficult to imagine that anyone else would know the answer to that question except for people in China. But I will say this about their facilities. They have a state-of-the-art BSL-3, BSL-4 facility that was designed and actually discussed with groups here in the United States that also have BSL-3 and BSL-4. facilities. And so the design and the function of that facility in terms of its safety has been well reviewed. Exactly how they work in that facility is something that, you know, it'd be very difficult for a Westerner to know unless they had access to the facility. And it's very difficult to get into any nation's BSL-3, high containment BSL-3, BSL-4 facility. So I don't know the answer to that question. So the main problems that the Institute of Virology has is that the outbreak occurred in close proximity to that institute. That institute has, in essence, the best collection of virologists in the world that have gone out and seeked out and isolated and sampled bat species throughout Southeast Asia. And so they have a very large collection of viruses in their laboratory. And so it's, you know, proximity is a problem. It's a problem.
And makes it look bad in any event.
It makes it look bad in any event. And there's no way to stop that speculation unless China decides to do open, transparent review of what was in the facility and what was going on at the time. At this time, there are equally, if not more compelling arguments for the emergence of this virus. I guess it's maybe it's human behavior, the way humans think, to think that the natural disasters don't normally happen. But again, think back to the history of coronaviruses. You know, 7 new human coronaviruses all coming out of animals. So it's not a big leap to think that this came out of animals. And the closest relative to this virus is a bat virus called RATG13, which is about 96% identical. It was identified in a cave in Yunnan province. And so it, you know, its closest relative is a bat virus. It's also known that people that work in and around bat hibernacula in China, either collecting the guano for fertilizer or collecting animals for food consumption, many of those individuals actually are seropositive against beta coronaviruses. And so they have antibodies against these SARS-like coronaviruses. That means they've been exposed in the wild. And when you think about COVID-19 in terms of its epidemiology and pathogenesis, many, if not most, infections are asymptomatic. The virus can transverse through these invisible transmission networks and infect many, many people before you see a serious case. So it's quite conceivable, if not even more likely, that a person in rural China became exposed in the setting of working in and around these bat caves. They transmitted to others in a rural setting, and eventually someone went to an urban setting where there was high density and many, many people, and that caused the expanding pandemic. So the second possibility is that open markets actually contributed to this outbreak. The last common ancestor for the SARS-2 virus is predicted to have emerged in October. By the time the Chinese identified this cohort that was associated in and around an open market in December, there could have been many human-to-human transmission events that had begun a month and a half earlier.
Dr. Barrick, I'd like to change the subject just a little bit. And that is, I'd like to ask you about viruses, maybe even viruses in general. We hear that you can't kill viruses because they're not alive, which makes them sound like some kind of zombie pathogen. Can you explain that? Is that just completely wrong?
No. I don't like the idea that viruses are dead. Viruses are living organisms that go through a phase outside of the host where they are functionally inert. So they're not dead because they can still transmit. They may sit on a table for 2 or 3 days before they transmit. They're not dead at that time. They're just quiescent. They're waiting. And once they get into a susceptible cell, they immediately begin to replicate and produce babies. And those are lots of babies. You can make 10,000 to 100,000 viruses from a singly infected cell, single virus infected cell. So they are living, breathing entities. Well, they're not really breathing. They're living entities that want to replicate and transmit. and maintain themselves in the world.
And so, they're very efficient at that replication, aren't they?
Well, they are. You know, they different viruses have different strategies to maintain themselves in human populations. Some, like herpes viruses, can produce latent infections, and they'll just go quiet, sitting in neurons or other tissue in the human host until you undergo some kind of immunosuppression event, and then the virus will pop back up and reactivate. Other viruses have a much higher risk strategy for maintaining themselves in humans, you know, culminating in something like influenza, which lives by infecting people, infecting as many people as possible. As more and more people begin to become infected, there's a herd immunity. In other words, the herd that's being attacked by the virus develops immunity that protects itself against that virus, and then flu has to either evolve or go extinct. And so every few years, flu it either evolves or goes extinct. And so that's a very high-risk lifestyle, but obviously flu has figured out to do it quite successfully. So different viruses have different tricks to maintain themselves in human and animal hosts. Most of the time, these interactions are relatively benign, but sometimes these interactions are pathogenic. And certainly pathogens throughout recorded history have been capable of causing tremendous human suffering. In the 20th century, for example, smallpox has killed over 200 million people. When it was eradicated. We have the 1918 flu, which killed somewhere between 25 and 50 million people in 1918, 1919. And of course, we have HIV, which has infected over 30 million people since its emergence in 1982. And the density, the closeness that we have to each other is beginning to provide optimum environments for pandemic disease outbreaks.
Dr. Barrick, you said something a few minutes ago that really caught my attention, and that was that a virus like SARS-CoV-2 could stay viable on a surface for maybe a couple of days. And that brings us to a very controversial topic, because there have been some studies that suggested, yes, the SARS-CoV-2 virus can be viable on plastic, on perhaps a doorknob, perhaps on cardboard for several hours or maybe even a couple of days. And the biggest controversy has to do about aerosolization. Viral particles have been found in air vents, on PPE, in the air at hospitals and biocontainment areas at greater than 6 feet from the source. But the question that everybody wants answered is, are those particles viable? Could they lead to infection?
So this is another great question. Classically, coronaviruses are thought to be transmitted by large droplets and fomites. And so when you breathe, talk, or sneeze, small water droplets containing virus are released from your oral pharynx region. And they can be transmitted directly to people if they're standing close enough to breathe it in, or they can deposit on surfaces and then stay infectious for some period of time. In the case of SARS-CoV-2, it depends on what that surface is and the matrix that it sits in. So, for example, I can run some quick statistics through for you on money. If you start with about 10 to the fifth virus particles, which is about 100,000 viruses, you'll still have low-level virus there about a day and a half later. If you have that same amount of virus on metal, it's about 2 days. Plastic, about a day and a half. On PPE, like a mask, it can be there for 4 days. And these are all at room temperature. So the virus is quite stable at room temperature, and as it gets colder, it stays, those times become longer and longer. So in the wintertime, they can stay on surfaces for quite some time. If you increase the temperature or increase exposure to sunlight, those times can be dramatically reduced. And so if you heat the all of those surfaces up to over 37 degrees, you probably cut all those times down by greater than half. If you heat it up a little more than that, then the virus will last for just hours on those surfaces. So it just depends on the matrix that it's in, the on what it's on top of, and what the temperature and the humidity and the environment is around the sample.
And of course, that 37 degrees is centigrade.
Yes, body temperature. Sorry, body temperature. Yes.
Dr. Barrick, you just mentioned that the SARS-CoV-2 virus could, in some cases, persist for a day or even 2 days, depending on the surrounding conditions. I'm wondering about the 6-foot thing, because the World Health Organization and the CDC suggest that as long as you're 6 feet away from somebody, nothing to worry about. The FDA says you don't have to worry about those packages that come from, you know, some delivery service or some grocery store. Just get on with your life. Not a problem. Your thoughts, please.
So that's a big unanswered question in terms of SARS-CoV-2 transmission. The virus is highly transmissible. And so it seems to many that large droplet spread and fomite transmission, you know, touching a virus on the surface of a table and inserting it mechanically into your nose, which is how most people get infected, is not the only answer for the rapid spread of this virus in human populations. And so people, when they sneeze or when they talk, can generate both large and small particles. And the small particles, less than 5 microns, can hang in the air for 2 to 6 hours. And if they have virus in it, it allows for what's called small droplet spread. In terms of you walk through an area where people are talking, you can actually pick up the virus and become infected. So there's a couple interesting features about SARS and these emerging SARS-2 and these other emerging coronaviruses, in that some people, and this is some speculation, by the way, some people are super spreaders. There's examples in both SARS-1, MERS, and SARS-2 where infected people move through an emergency room that has staff and other people waiting for care and infect a large number of people, 13, 17 people, and they've only been in the proximity for a very short period of time. There's some suggestion that perhaps some people could actually be small droplet spreaders. And it's interesting that depending on sort of anatomical features in the lung, some people, a small subset of people, are actually super microparticle generators, where they can generate small particles that much more efficiently than other people. And so those kind of things, when you start putting them together with the available evidence that suggests that there is viral nucleic acid present in small droplets, that the chance for aerosol spread or small droplet spread is a real possibility. I think the key experiments that need to be done is to show, there's two. One is the virus in the small droplets? Is it infectious? And then the second question, which is much harder to get at, is what's the infectious dose in humans? So as you move to smaller and smaller particles, obviously the number of viruses that can be packed into those small particles becomes less and less. And so it may be a scenario where the number of particles that you need to establish an infection can't be accomplished in many cases, and so it's not an issue of concern. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done on this. Certainly wearing masks, in my opinion, is a good idea. An N95 mask is best, but some kind of surgical mask or cloth protection that would help contain large and small droplets if you sneeze, and if other people sneeze, it would also help reduce the chance of spread to you. So I'm a big fan of using some kind of mask protection for people.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The State of Things, featuring an episode of the program The People's Pharmacy. It's produced in the studios of WUNC and hosted by Terry and Joe Graydon. They're talking with Ralph Barrick, one of the world's leading coronavirus researchers. He's also a professor of epidemiology at UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Let's return to that conversation now and learn more about remdesivir, an antiviral drug that was granted emergency use authorization by the FDA earlier this month. Joe and Terry asked him to talk more about the excitement about remdesivir and the challenges of drug research.
A fundamental problem in emerging diseases is that you don't know what's coming. You don't know what it looks like. It's hard to convince a company to develop a drug against an unknown. And even if you made a drug, there's no population of infected individuals to test it. And so this has resulted in Planet Earth's strategy to respond to new emerging pathogens as a reactive strategy rather than a proactive strategy. So about, I guess it's about 7-8 years now, Mark Dennison, who's a professor at Vanderbilt, and my lab, myself, decided that we were going to try to develop broad-based inhibitors that would work against all coronaviruses. And we're fortunate to be part of a Center for Excellence in Translational Research. That was a sort of a high-risk funding program that was developed by the NIH to try to move drugs and vaccines to pre-IND positions so that they could rapidly go into the clinic should there be an outbreak of disease. And so we were fortunate to be funded on this program, that is led by Rich Whitley at the University of Alabama. We were also fortunate to negotiate with Gilead Scientific to get them to donate a panel of drugs that they weren't developing for sort of common human infections, things like HIV, hepatitis C, RSV, flu, that were on their shelf, but that they thought might have some utility as drugs on a shelf for emerging diseases. And so we began screening those drugs and screening another big block of drugs and came across the drug. It's called a ribonucleoside inhibitor. Its name is remdesivir. And it turned out to be very, very potent in blocking SARS and MERS coronavirus infection in cells and culture. So we moved that into a more relevant model system using what are called primary human airway cells. These are cells that are obtained from the discarded lungs from transplant recipients. You can grow them on what are called culture systems such that they take on the architecture and organization of the human airway. And so we then ask the question, will these drugs work against these viruses, these coronaviruses, in terms of their natural host? And typically SARS and MERS infect these ciliated airway cells. And it turns out the drug worked great against that. And so then we tested it against the common human coronaviruses, and it worked against them. And we tested it against zoonotic and high, sort of what we call pre-epidemic SARS and MERS bat-like strains that are poised for cross-species movement, and it worked against those. And so we were quite excited about the in vitro data. We then moved that data into animal models of human disease and showed that it worked in animal models for MERS and SARS and some of these other viruses. And so basically, in collaboration with Gilead, we produced all the preliminary, what's called pre-IND data, that would get this through the FDA process so that it could be positioned for phase one human trials. That process took about 6 years. And when COVID-19 emerged in December, almost immediately we were in a position to begin phase one testing of the drug and in phase two testing of the drug in about 5 locations around the globe. Importantly, today, Tony Fauci reported some of the results, some of the early results of the NIH trial that they have been conducting, and they showed that the drug was very effective at reducing the number of days that infected people are in the hospital by about 4 days. And also there was a reduction in mortality, although it did not approach, it was not completely significant. And the significance there was most likely impacted by the fact that they stopped the study early because they knew they had a drug that was working. And so it's a huge development for the treatment of COVID-19 infections. I think it gives people hope that there is a therapy that we know works if it's given early and has a chance to help people all over the world help fight off this this life-threatening disease.
Well, Dr. Barrick, thank you so much for having started this research so many years ago so that we are actually ready to go with testing into phase two and then now phase three trials. I've got a question for you about what I'll call ease of use, because remdesivir is an injectable drug, and therefore it's used primarily in hospitals. You and your team have also been studying a drug that could be taken orally. What can you tell us about EIDD-2801? How is it similar and how is it different from remdesivir?
That's a good question. I'm glad you led into that. So we actually have our group, again, in collaboration with Mark Dennison at Vanderbilt, and in this case, in collaboration with George Painter at Emory University, had identified a drug, call it NHC. It's the easiest way to say it. It's basically, a nucleoside inhibitor, much like remdesivir, but it does have a different mechanism of action. We began studying this about 2.5 years ago and demonstrated that it worked in cell culture, just like I told you before, for remdesivir. It had that same breadth of activity. It also worked in animal models of human disease against both MERS and SARS. And also we have shown that it works against SARS-2. And so that data was published, I guess, about a month ago. That drug is currently in phase 1 trials in England, which is basically a dose escalation study that looks to see if it's toxic. If it makes it through that process, it will go immediately into phase 2 studies in the U.S. and elsewhere. The drug is similar but different. It's, again, very potent against all coronaviruses that we have available in the laboratory, and especially all these new emerging coronaviruses. It works by causing what's called error catastrophe. And so when RNA viruses replicate, they make mutations fairly frequently. I'll give you an example. When we replicate our DNA, we make the DNA polymerases make a mistake about once every million to 10 million base pairs that it synthesizes. Our cells are filled with DNA repair enzymes that fix that so that the actual mutation rate is like 1 in 1 billion, 1 in 100 million, or actually closer to 1 in 1 billion. So we make very few mistakes when we replicate our DNA. Viruses, RNA viruses, have a mutation rate of about 10 to the minus 4th, or about 1 out of every 1,000 to 10,000 nucleotides that they synthesize. They make a mistake. And so what NHC does is it causes that mutation rate to go up significantly, 10, 20, 100-fold. And so there are so many mutations that are being introduced into the virus genome that it just kills it. It's death by lethal mutagenesis. And so that's how that works. Remdesivir is different in that it causes a process called chain termination. When remdesivir gets incorporated into the RNA of daughter strands that are being made when the virus is replicating, it causes the RNA synthesis to stop and dislocate or knock the viral RNA molecule off the template so it doesn't get completely synthesized and it's dead. So both cases, both drugs cause death, but by different mechanisms. The advantage of NHC is that it's an oral drug, so you could take it at home. And patients with mild disease could take it at home, they don't have to go to the hospital to be admitted to have the drug given, administered by IV, which is what the case is with remdesivir. So it has a lot of potential, and I hope it gets into phase two trials here shortly. So that's the current status of that second drug.
Dr. Barrick, in addition to the exciting preliminary results from remdesivir, there are a lot of other clinical trials underway. There's a heartburn medicine you can buy over the counter called famotidine, the brand name Pepcid. Of course, a lot of controversy around hydroxychloroquine. There's a very old vaccine called BCG, Bacillus Calmette-Guerin. Any thoughts, any interest in any of those other treatments?
Humanity hasn't seen a pandemic caused by a highly pathogenic respiratory virus since 1918. And when it emerged from a class of viruses that we had no drugs. We have had a few trials that were done with SARS and MERS with unclear results. And so the number of drugs that were available for the attending physicians to treat this new pandemic virus was virtually zero. So there was a fair amount of in vitro data showing that compound X, like hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, could block virus replication if it could be given prophylactically. And so that makes quite, you know, in the absence of anything else, and the fact that we know this drug has been used to treat malaria for years, it makes sense that it moved into the clinic. Whether or not it's efficacious, I think the data is moving more toward potentially inducing more harm than doing more good at this moment, although more robust trials will be reported in the next few weeks to months. So anyway, physicians were in a difficult spot, right? They needed to try to treat the disease to enhance the survival probabilities of patients that they were seeing. And so what happened was that physicians were given the opportunity to test new drugs with very little data in support of their efficacy. And so they have tried many different things, some of which were supported by data that would suggest that it might work. Others were based on what's known about the mechanism of SARS and MERS pathogenesis and the pathways that are involved that were important for severe disease. That suggested other potential therapies that could be tested. And so they tried them. And that's what happens. I guess that is the mode of operation in terms of how medicine now responds to a new emerging pathogen, a high path pathogen that's capable of causing a lot of morbidity and mortality. Clearly, I think the globe needs to do a better job of being proactive. One way, for example, is that if you'd written a grant before COVID-19 emerged and you were arguing that you wanted to try to repurpose existing drugs to see if any of them could work against a new emerging coronavirus, that was not supported very much either by companies or by the NIH or by reviewers who would review these programs, because repurposed drugs was not the way to go in terms of the way people were thinking. Now we have a pandemic outbreak of respiratory disease and everybody's trying repurposed drugs. So we could have had a little more foresight, and I hope we have more foresight in the future.
Dr. Barrick, we are nearly out of time. Are you optimistic that we will find a treatment, come up with a vaccine, find some way to stop this pandemic in the foreseeable future?
I think by the fall, we'll have two or three effective therapies that will be able to be used for humans who are infected. The key for all of them will be early administration. Even in our animal models, we know that if you wait too long and patients or animals develop this this terrible disease called acute respiratory distress syndrome, that once patients get into that or animals get into that disease process, direct acting antivirals will be not very effective. And a whole new class of inhibitors have to be developed to try to treat that disease. The truth is the NIH has spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to develop strategies to treat acute respiratory distress syndrome. It kills about 1 million people a year, and it's a devastating end-stage lung disease, devastating, very, very difficult for clinicians to treat it. Basically, what happens is your lungs either fill up with fluid so that you drown, and you can't get oxygen, and so your tissues start dying, and then that causes death. Or alternatively, it causes causes this disease called a fibrotic disease, where there's lots of wound repair and fibroblasts that are laid down that prevent oxygen exchange, and that causes you to suffocate. So it's just a terrible disease. And so, I mean, you hear of cases of patients being intubated for a month or 2 months, and that's just terrible. That part of the disease is really difficult to treat. So currently, I think we will have therapies that will work if the patients get it early, and I think it will be effective. Vaccines, I think we're making progress. There are some potential complications that could affect the delivery of vaccines that can affect the timeline and the efficacy of those vaccines. But the good news is that we are well along the road to testing them. And we'll see what happens. And I'm hopeful that we will have a therapy both for drugs that will treat the disease, but also vaccines within about 18 months that can protect the public against this terrible pathogen.
That's epidemiologist Ralph Barrick talking with Terry and Joe Graydon. You've been listening to a special broadcast of The State of Things featuring an episode of the program The People's Pharmacy. You can learn more about the Barrick Lab and all of their coronavirus research at our website, stateofthings.org. The People's Pharmacy is produced by Lynn Siegel and engineered by Al Wadarski. Dave Graydon edits their interviews, and you can learn more about that program at peoplespharmacy.com. You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. And that's the program for today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.